The month in review. Many people in Maine started this month in the dark as utility crews worked for days to restore power to hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses after a wild storm. That same week, the governor vetoed the legislature's plan to implement marijuana regulation, and the legislature was unable to override his veto. On Election Day, the people of Maine soundly defeated an effort to build a casino in York County and voted in favor of expanding Medicaid coverage. And that was all just the first week of November. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The news just kept coming, with Sean Moody adding his hat to the gubernatorial race, allegations of sexual misconduct nationally and here at home, and Susan Collins again at the center of a big Senate debate, this time about tax reform. We'll discuss it all with the editorial page editors from three of Maine's daily newspapers. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. November began with power outages and damage from a fierce windstorm. The month is ending with questions about which way Senator Collins will vote on a massive tax overhaul bill. She's supposed to be addressing the Senate as we are on the air for this program. Well, today our panel of editorial page editors joins me to discuss the major newsmaking events of the month of November. In the studio with me, Greg Kesich, who is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories from November mattered most to you or matter most to you? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back, everybody.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start with a big cultural story right now. The deluge of sexual misconduct accusations against men in powerful places. Maine has not been spared. The sheriff of Oxford County is in the spotlight here. Ben, he is accused of sexting and making unwanted solicitations. And we're just now finding out that he's been under investigation for a while, right?
This first surfaced a couple weeks ago when WGME obtained a photo of Sheriff Wayne Glant in some state of undress and also wearing his sheriff's uniform. When that story broke, the sheriff said that he had taken that photo a couple years ago. He had sent it to a woman. He called it an adult thing. And he said he was embarrassed and he resigned from his president. He was president of the Maine Sheriff's Association. He stepped down from that, but remained as sheriff as Oxford County. But then it came out that the Press Herald actually broke the story that the county commissioners that were already investigating him for, propositioning one of his underlings and then sending a photo to that person's wife. That came out through the union. The union says that this all happened, and he's denying it and saying that he will absolutely not step down.
And it's not clear what happens now, right? Because the sheriff is elected,
right,
and the county commissioners are the only body that could do something,
well,
it seems.
Well, as we found out a couple of months ago, the Maine Constitution does allow the governor to get rid of a sheriff, take a sheriff out if he's not not fulfilling his duties. Governor LePage wanted to do this to some of the sheriffs who weren't cooperating with immigration officials. So that would really be the county commissioners, you're right, can't. They only have kind of budgetary control over the sheriff's department. And as an elected official, he can stay in, as long as he wants, unless the governor decides to act.
Well, Susan, even before we heard about Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor, the Bangor Daily News had a column, a big editorial just a few days ago. The headline, "When Justice for Sexual Assault Comes from Being Believed," looking at a sea change in culture.
Absolutely. I think what we're seeing, hearing, and reading is that women are being believed. I mean, we'll find out soon what happens with Roy Moore in Alabama. but Mitch McConnell and others pretty, definitively saying, I believe the women. And that really feels like a new sentiment. Greg Kesich had a great column about this in the Press Herald and another one today. I haven't heard anyone say, what were these women wearing? Were they drunk? Mm-hmm. The usual, they did something to bring this upon themselves. Not naive enough to think that that rhetoric is gone forever, but it just feels like we're in such a different landscape where finally these kind of accusations are being taken seriously, and employers, including National Public Radio, are taking them seriously, and men finally are facing consequences for this kind of action.
Yeah, and Greg, your column focusing on Al Franken.
Yeah. I mean, something really has changed, and I think it's unclear exactly what it is. But at the core of it is what Susan just said, is that the default now is to believe these women. And we're seeing a lot more complaints. The complaints of sexual harassment are way up in the Maine Human Rights Commission, and pretty reliable research shows that most people don't ever make a complaint, and you can see why. It can end your career. It can force you, to, even if you are vindicated, you could lose your job. You could have a hard time finding another one in that field. So I think we should, pay attention to the number of complaints and realize, like, we're seeing more complaints, but not more conduct. This stuff has been going on right along. One of the pushbacks that I'm hearing is men saying, well, now no man is safe, which, maybe that's true. Maybe men were feeling too safe. That a lot of these acts were signs that people were not afraid of being caught, or if it became an issue of one person's word against another, they weren't worried about anybody not believing their word, and they're going to have to be thinking about that now.
I want to return to this. You mentioned the Maine Human Rights Commission saying the numbers are up, the complaints are up in the last couple of years over years prior. That was not the first story the Press Herald reported.
No.
What happened?
We reported a story where our reporter contacted the Maine Human Rights Commission, and they were informed that the numbers are way down. And we wrote an editorial that said, those numbers can't really tell the real story, because there's no way this is happening absolutely everywhere in our society, but not in Maine. And then the next day, the Human Rights Commission, to their credit, called back and said, no, we miscalculated, and the numbers have actually spiked. But I think that's an illustration of something that's going on now is we're not looking at these like isolated incidents, and we're not looking at them as different kind of offenses. We're looking at them more as a cultural pattern, and maybe different degrees of seriousness, but of the same kind of conduct. That the things that range from unwelcome comments and belittling jokes all the way up to sexual assault are all part of the same continuum. So I think the Human Rights Commission is, rightfully looking at the fact pattern of each individual complaint, and that's what they're supposed to do. But I think for the rest of us, I think we need to take a step back and say, why is there so much of this, this whole range of behavior?
Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, the question, I guess, all along it has been, who do you go to? If you're working a low-level staffer at NBC News and Matt Lauer sexually harasses you, who do you go to? And with all this coming out now, places like NBC News and congressional offices are probably going to put in place ways for people to come forward. The question is, where do you go if you're working at a restaurant and your manager is asking for sexual favors for certain time, for certain shifts, or you work at a retail store? I mean, you're supposed to go to the Maine Human Rights Commission, but on a big year, we're only getting about 190 complaints, and that seems very low.
And the Maine Human Rights Commission is very limited in what it can do.
Yes, understaffed, underfunded, not a whole lot of authority. So that's something that people are going to have to look at, you know, as we go forward to give people the protection. Now that we know this is, I mean, there's no doubt that this is happening everywhere.
I'm going to change the subject from one huge important topic to another one, and that's what's going on in the Senate right now, debating a tax overhaul plan. We're waiting for Senator Collins to speak before the Senate. Susan Young, do we have any idea how she's going to vote on this?
I don't think so. I mean, it almost feels like it changes hour by hour. The latest reporting that, you know, she's not at yes, that there are still, I believe, six changes that she wants to the legislation. Obviously, the inclusion of the repeal of the individual mandate under the Affordable Care Act is a big sticking point for her. Also, changes to deductions and things of that sort. So, I mean, we really don't know. They're in such a rush, as they have been with efforts to repeal the ACA and some other legislation. How many amendments are they going to allow? Are they going to have full consideration? You know, we've had no hearings on this bill, no analysis by the Joint Commission on Taxation. So, you know, if every senator has as many amendments as Senator Collins, you know, this will drag out well beyond what leadership wants. So, you know, I think all bets are off at this point.
Greg, Ben, thoughts on what Senator Collins is going to do?
Well, she's in a really, as usual, we've said before, in a really difficult position because, you know, her constituency is bigger than her party in terms of in Maine, anyway. And she is very popular statewide. And I think people have a lot of confidence in her decision making. From what I hear, according to polls, she's underwater among Republicans. People identify as Republicans who are, more people disapprove than approve. And I don't think that's a position she's comfortable in. I think she has been appeared to be looking for a way to fix this so that she could vote yes and take care of her biggest concerns, but still stick with, you know, really what's core orthodox Republican economic policy, which is cut taxes. You know, there's a recession, you cut taxes. If there's a, you know, if you have a surplus, you cut taxes, and they want to cut taxes, and that's supposed to be the thing that they can all agree on. And so she is trying to find a way to make a vehicle where she can, I think, find a way to say yes. And I don't know that this is fixable.
Ben Bragdon, Sean Moody entered the race for the governor's the governor's race. Are we at 20?
I think so. Yeah, around there.
What's interesting about this on a lot of levels, Sean Moody ran as an independent last time, and a lot of people voted for him. A lot of people liked him. This time running as a Republican, not only running as a Republican, but has staffers that worked for Governor LePage, including Governor LePage's daughter. Is this some sort of signal that the governor is not supporting Mary Mayhew or another one of the Republicans, but instead going to support Sean Moody, who was an independent?
Yeah, if I mean, it's kind of an unmistakable signal, I would think, from the LePage section of the party that, you know, everyone kind of assumed that maybe Ken Fredette, who has, you know, been carrying his water in the legislature all these years, really holding the line on a lot of his priorities in the House, as he did with the Maine Care expansion, as he did with the budget, and of course, Mary Mayhew, who was his Health and Human Services Commissioner, who oversaw all the major changes that we've come to identify Governor LePage with. So it's a little of a surprise that he'd go outside. I mean, I'm sure those two were counting on it, that they might get his support at some point. But now it looks like he maybe sees a little bit of himself in Sean Moody, you know, a self-made guy who is a lot more kind of folksy and, I guess, nicer, for lack of a better word, than Governor LePage. But he says basically the same things. You know, one of the problems with this state is that there's too much welfare, and that gives people incentive to sit around, and that's our problem. That's what he said at his announcement, and that looks like it's going to be the focus of his campaign, which, you know, fits really well with what the governor says.
Craig, is he the front runner now in the Republican race? Is it too early to call someone a front runner?
Yeah, I guess so. Although with so many candidates, you have to look at the names that really jump out. And his name certainly does, especially with, you know, the backing that he's getting that you mentioned. You know, in addition to Lauren LePage, there's also Brent Littlefield, who is a now based in Washington, political consultant, but is a Mainer who worked behind the scenes for both LePage campaigns and Bruce Poliquin, and is a I think a really important person in terms of crafting that particular kind of Republican message. One thing I thought was interesting was you know, Sean Moody's incredibly nice guy, right? He's a very engaging, charming person to talk to. He remembers your name, you know. He remembers the last time you met. He's just somebody, a very personable guy. And they set up this announcement with no questions from the press, which, you know, seems to me like you're holding back his most you know, his strongest quality. And I guess it's because they didn't want to muddy the message, and they didn't want the first day's story to be, you know, whatever the press asked about, like, you know, what's Sean Moody's position on abortion? We don't know. What's his position on Medicaid? We don't know. Immigration? We don't know. But we do know that he built a business, you know, from scratch when he was in high school, and you know, believes in hard work.
Susan Young, what
I think
are your
Greg
thoughts?
Go
ahead.
I think Greg brings up a really important point. One of Sean Moody's appeals when he ran in 2010 was that he was a nice guy. He was very personable. He was very human. And his message on welfare and assistance was pretty compassionate. And I think there's a risk if he's heavily managed by someone like Brent Littlefield, who, as Greg noted, you know, don't talk to the press. He's already gone much farther to the right on welfare. Does he lose that personality, that likability that people were attracted to in 2010? Will they like him as much if he's kind of LePage light?
We have to go to a break. We still haven't talked about Medicaid expansion and the future of that. So hoping that the three of you can shed some light on that when we get back. We also want to hear from you in the audience. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Support for Maine Calling comes from listeners like you. Thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, are we at a turning point in how we handle allegations of sexual harassment? We'll also look back on how Anita Hill's allegations against Clarence Thomas were handled in his confirmation hearings. We'll hear from New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer, who wrote a book about the hearings, and Rebecca Traister, who writes about feminist issues. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. We'd like to give a special thanks to Jean from Damariscotta for donating her Isuzu Rodeo. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program do make a big difference for your public radio station, and in most cases it results in a tax deduction for you. Towing is free, and you can rest easy knowing that your vehicle gained extra mileage for the programming that you enjoy and count on. If you're thinking of what to do with your car, we hope you'll consider Maine Public. You can visit mainepublic.org, click Support, then Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program for more information. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the stories that made headlines in Maine in November. With me in the studio, Greg Kesich, who is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young. She's editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. What have you been following closely in November, especially in Maine news or national news that really pertains to Maine? So we started this month with an election, Greg, and in the election, we just put down that casino measure. What was it? In the 80 percentile, the no vote. But also a very strong vote in favor of Medicaid expansion. The final number, about 60%.
About, just under 60, 59.
Yeah. So as soon as this, very strong vote occurred, the governor said, that's, I'm paraphrasing here, that's nice, but I'm not providing extra funding. If you want to fund it, you're going to have to find a way. What happens now?
It depends on who you ask, but I think you're right that the vote was very convincing. 60% spread out all over the state. It was not the usual, greater Portland and up the coast split that we've seen in other kind of more controversial issues. And so the proponents say that he cannot stop it from happening, and that he they'll take him to court if he doesn't if he tries to interfere with its implementation. The reality is that there's certain things that have to be done before the federal government will start chipping in their money, and one of the things is you're going to require you to spend some money, and one of the things they're disputing with each other is just how much money the state really needs to raise. The expectation is when the program is fully implemented, it'll be something in the neighborhood of $50 million a year, which sounds like a lot of money, but that draws down about $500 million from the federal government, which would be spent in Maine hospitals and Maine doctors. And in general, we would consider that a pretty good trade-off. But now the Republicans are saying that the Democrats have to come up with the whole $50 million, and at least some of the Democrats are saying no, it's not really $50 million because you're talking about a partial year and you won't be fully implemented before the end of the year. So it might be something more like $12 or $13 million, and there's plenty of money in surplus for that. So that's the kind of, I think we're going to see a really pitched battle starting in January about how much money it really would require to get the thing going. And I expect that the administration's going to continue to drag its feet, because why wouldn't they? They've done he's done everything he could to prevent this from happening. And he just has to run out the clock for another, 13 months.
Susan Young, do we have any sense of timeline on this? If I'm listening to this program today and I'm one of those people who makes too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough money to get a subsidy under the ACA, when might I be able to get health insurance under this expanded Medicaid? Possibly.
It goes back to what Greg said. I mean, there's a timeline that gets us to court, but beyond that, we don't know what will happen. I mean, the law goes into effect 45 days after the legislature convenes, which will be in early January. And then my understanding is 180 days after that, the folks that qualify for coverage under the expanded Medicaid will be eligible for services. It's very unlikely that the state will have anything set up by that point for the funding reasons that Greg mentioned. But also, I don't foresee DHHS putting the rules and regulations in place that are needed. So that 180 days passes. I would assume that some advocates are going to gather together people who would qualify for insurance and aren't getting it because the state hasn't put the system in place, and then they will go to court. So that's the timeline that I see, but I don't know what happens after that.
Ben Bragdon, are you hearing from people who are frustrated that this appears to be yet another referendum passed by the Maine voters that may or may not actually happen? The will of the voters is kind of negotiable here.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just as with the marijuana legalization and the school funding, extra funding that passed, and all these ranked choice voting, all these other things that have kind of lost their way in the legislature. People feel that when they go to the polls and they vote for something, that it's going to get implemented. But we know that's not true, and maybe people are just kind of getting used to that a little bit. It might be a case of sure, people are upset that it's not going to go through, but are the people who hold it, who are going to hold this up in the legislature, are they going to suffer for it? That's the question. Are the House Republicans who are going to get in the way of funding this going to suffer? We know Governor LePage isn't going to. He's not running again. So he's, I'm sure, is ready to die on this hill. And I can't imagine anyone benefiting from Maincare expansion until he's out of office.
And I think probably Kent Verdet is, too. He's the Republican floor leader, and he holds together this caucus, the core of which is made up of House members who were elected in 2010 with LePage, who have been his most loyal backers during preventing vetoes from being overridden. And I don't see what incentive any of them have to suddenly decide to try to work across the aisle.
It's a little interesting, like you mentioned earlier, that Maincare expansion passed in a couple of districts where the legislators that represent those districts were some of the biggest opponents of it. Mm-hmm. And, it was, 52-48 in some of those places.
Well, I want to get to that point because that's interesting, Ben. And I will get to calls and emails in just a second. But, Greg, you wrote a column about this in the middle of the month about, there's some mixed messages coming from Maine voters. They're voting for, especially in the second district, conservative Republican candidates, but then they're voting for marijuana legalization. They're voting for the expansion of Medicaid,
minimum wage, raising taxes on the wealthy. It really is interesting. It's the kind of candidates who are winning elections seem to be at odds with the kind of issues that people support, and it's going to be this is going to be something very interesting for how the Democratic candidates for governor deal with this issue. I mean, do Democrats want to run a moderate who promises to kind of take a middle of the road view, or are they really looking for some strong economic populist? Lance Dutson had a great column in the BDN about Shelley Pingree. I mean, she is out there. She is rumored to be thinking about running for governor, and she's often left off our lists of possible candidates. But she is somebody who could really kind of capture that kind of economic populist appeal.
We'll go to Dennis calling from Bangor. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for waiting, and go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, good. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment about Senator Collins and the tax bill. I'm glad that Senator Collins feels that her particular concern regarding repeal of the individual mandate might be addressed by allowing her to submit a bill that mitigates that problem. But this tax bill is such a many-splendored disaster for ordinary Americans and ordinary Mainers that softening this one nasty strand of it really amounts to a minor tweak in the overall bill. It does nothing to alter the fundamental fact that the bill will be a budget-busting, large-scale transfer of wealth from government coffers and working and middle-class taxpayers to the very wealthiest individuals and corporations. The underlying justification for this is that corporate tax cuts ultimately pay for themselves and enriching the richest, who might then invest their gains, will somehow benefit us all. But these claims are unfounded, and it's not a matter of dispute among serious economists.
But all right, Dennis. And you'll be happy to know that we're going to talk more about the tax bill on Monday on Maine Calling. But, you know, we also have a tweet and an email, and all three are with you. They want Senator Collins to vote against this bill and feel like it's just terrible. What is she hearing, Susan? What's she hearing in her office?
Well, I know, you know, she's being flooded by calls and frankly from organized groups telling her to oppose this legislation. But she's also hearing from business groups, including small business owners, who want it to pass. And I think what Greg said earlier is very important. She's a Republican. Republicans are in favor of tax cuts. So her task, as he said, is to find a way to get to yes. And as Dennis mentioned, there are huge problems with this bill that concern a lot of us. But she's delineated her concerns. If she feels that she's got those addressed and can make that case, I think it's just as Greg said, she's looking for a way to get to yes.
Susan, are you getting a lot of letters supporting the tax bill? Letters to the editor?
No.
Yeah.
We've gotten a few from business owners and mostly organized business groups and coalitions. I mean, definitely it's 90% opposed.
Same with your papers?
Yeah. I mean, we've gotten a few from small business owners who are focused on the corporate tax cut part of it, which is something they really want, and frankly is not a bad part of the plan. But you know, there's so much else around it that taking just one piece and talking out of one piece behind it isn't very useful. But really, nothing from readers now.
Dennis, thanks for your call. Here's a related email from Jim. He writes, in the same article in the Kennebec Journal yesterday that indicated Senator Collins might vote yes was a section in which Senator King observed that a bipartisan approach to a tax bill could earn 70 votes in the Senate, enough to override. Many senators on both sides have admitted that a strictly partisan approach to anything leads to poor bills and a bad process. Do you think there's any hope Senator Collins might back away and support a better approach?
I mean, yes, hope. I mean, if that's, I mean, it depends on your perspective, right? But is that a possibility? I think so. I mean, I think it's possible that they can't put up together 50 votes on a bill that she feels comfortable with in the Senate
but
this time.
It was Senator John McCain who was given so much credit during the health care debate for calling for a regular Senate order and bipartisanship and yada, yada, yada. And there he is saying he supports this bill.
Yeah, I get the sense that they're a little too far along in this process to end with anything but a law, pass legislation, and that Susan Collins, for the good of her party, to get them this win that they really need, is looking for a way to get to that. And like they've both said, she really wants to cut taxes, to limit government, that sort of thing. And so she can kind of hold her nose and put up with this other stuff. All these amendments she's going to offer today, I don't see anything there that would make an absolute no for her. I think she's, you know, going to fight for those things, and if they don't get in, then she'll end up landing on a yes, because the party really needs this.
But does anybody understand why passing such an unpopular piece of legislation is considered a win? I mean, it seems like all the polling, and based on the reader comments we're getting, and the and letters to the editor, and calls to this show, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot of political upside to getting this done.
Isn't the cynical answer that the people who fund congressional campaigns are the people who like this tax bill?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. I'm sure they're hearing from the donors. And I have to think that part of this is short term. This bill isn't that bad. There are in the next few years, there are tax cuts for just about everybody. And the bad stuff comes later when you have to deal with a huge growing deficit, and what happens if we come into a recession with all these tax cuts, and what happens when the tax breaks for people making under $75,000 expire. But those are all problems for future people. I think just being able to say we passed a massive tax cut, we got this through, we helped small businesses, they think that that might just be enough. And they might actually believe that this is going to spur a lot of growth. I mean, there's no evidence of that, but that seems to be what they're hanging their hat on. And while a lot of that is politics, I think a lot of them probably believe that.
Susan?
I just want to add, going back to bipartisanship, I mean, we all talk about bipartisanship and we are in favor of it. Yeah. But let's remember how we got into this mess. It was the Democrats that changed the Senate rules to require only 50 votes to get their priorities passed. And, you know, here we are with the Republican leadership now, you know, with health care trying and with this tax bill possibly succeeding and passing very far-reaching legislation with just 50 votes. There were some editorial page editors probably in your studio and sitting up here right. Who said, be very careful what you do because you guys aren't going to be in charge forever. Yeah. And you know, when the other party's in charge and is pushing their priorities, you're not going to like it and you're going to wish you had a way to stop it.
I wasn't that smart. I said, go for it.
On that note, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Lots of comments about Senator Collins and the tax plan, but also, you know, do you have an opinion about the Medicaid expansion or about how long it took to get your power back on after the storm? We'd like to talk about a variety of issues. And before we take that quick break, a quick word about tomorrow's program. You have probably heard about the new guidelines regarding blood pressure levels. We will hear from experts about what these guidelines mean and how they might affect you. You can email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Support for Maine Calling comes from listeners like you. Thanks.
Facebook has some 2 billion members worldwide, but how many of these accounts are fake?
When I first signed up in 2008, I signed up with a made-up identity, and nobody has ever contacted me about not being on Facebook with my real name.
Facebook is asking its users to use real names, but does that work? I'm Kelly McEvers. Facebook fighting back against influence campaigns this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered later this evening from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And stay with us after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, it's Bill Nye the Science Guy discussing climate change and scientific thinking. Again, that's at 2 p.m. following Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Month in Review. Joining me today, Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Greg Kasich, the editorial page editor at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. If you guys can scrape your memory banks and go back to the beginning of the month, not even the year, the month. A lot of criticism, Greg, of the response to the storm. A lot of people angry, not just at how long it took to get their power back on, but feeling like they were not getting good information about when their power might come on. Do you remember back that far?
I do. I mean, it was a really big storm. It was an unusual storm. A lot of people, I mean, it was, in terms of just sheer numbers, it was as bad as the ice storm, even though it didn't have the kind of
the cold.
The cold and the ice. people were not happy with the grid. I should say, disclose, I live in Portland, and my lights flickered for like a second, and
oh man,
so I didn't. I just read about it in the newspaper. you had a different experience, though, right?
I did have a different experience, and we had a different experience here in the studios as well. We'll go to Frederick, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah. Hi. Good afternoon, Jennifer and guests. I wanted to offer that we cannot be surprised by the governor's actions and the conservatives in the state legislature, because they are simply marching to the tune of this Koch brother conservative mantra, right, of of an antithesis, really a guttural hatred of government playing an active role. And we see that the citizens time and again vote for, you mentioned, Jennifer, just recently, the Medicaid expansion. We voted for a higher tax on people above $200,000. We voted on ranked choice voting. The citizens are active, are stating a desire for an activist form of government, which really is an activist form of democracy. But the cancer in this state and in our society is this libertarian belief that the free market and the concentration of wealth, damned if you don't have it, it's too bad, you just don't fit into the corporate less government attitude.
And Frederick, let me ask you, why do you think the Maine voters vote for what we were talking about before, these collection of measures that would be characterized as progressive, and yet, especially in the 2nd District, are voting for conservative Republicans to represent them?
It's very interesting. I've studied, it's been written about frequently that the Democrats have a problem in presenting people that do not relate in a very sincere way of with their constituents. People don't necessarily vote on policy. They vote on other attributes. Like, I'm not saying the Democrats aren't trustworthy, but a conservative mindset is more interested in other factors such as relatability. Do they see themselves in this candidate? And when we offer people that don't necessarily fit the district that people are running for, then they don't vote on policy, Jennifer. People vote on a guttural sense of relatedness.
Yeah, Frederick, interesting point. Ben?
Yeah, I think he's got a point there. The Democrats have, in a lot of ways, in Maine and nationwide, become, you know, they talk a lot about the environment and about clean energy and about equal rights. I don't know that those are topics that resonate with people in the 2nd District very well. I think their economic message wealth accumulating towards the top and the loss of worker rights and things like that do. But I think it's a matter of message and a matter of, like, personality that people they put out there. That maybe when people are voting for candidates, they're voting for personality, and then when they're voting for issues, they're voting for issues.
We'll go to Maggie, who's calling from the Lake Region. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I love your show, and this one is really terrific. I work with lakes all across the state with the Maine Lake Society, and I wanted to bring everyone's attention to the upcoming budget vote on December 8th and the importance of Senator King and Senator Collins to stand up for the EPA budget. And here I am. I want you to know I'm not a Democrat. I'm a what you would call maybe a radical centrist. But I am going to talk about the environment. I think very few people in Maine know that our lakes generate over $3.5 billion a year in spending in our state, employ over 55,000 people every year, fund essential services in rural
Maggie,
towns.
I very much appreciate your call, and I think you got your message through. We're trying to talk about the month in review, so I appreciate you calling in, and we will be paying attention to the upcoming vote on this program and in the newsroom. We're going to move on to Michael in Kittery. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to try to be brief about it. I wanted to, I think, correct possibly a comment that one of your commentators made a few minutes ago about, I think she said that there are organized groups that are calling in asking Senator Collins to not vote for the tax plan. I've been calling in. I'm not an organized group, and I know a lot of my friends that are not organized groups. We're Maine citizens. We're just people, and we're concerned and we're worried about what's about to happen.
Sure.
So, maybe we should get organized.
I think there's
maybe
both, isn't there? Susan Young, we've got both, right?
Yeah, I mean, just look on Facebook, all the groups that are posting Senator Collins' various phone numbers and encouraging people to call. I mean, of course, average citizens are calling, too, and we don't want to downplay that at all. But there's an effort to get people to reach out and call her as well.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. We'll move on. We've got Marty Grohman, who is a state representative and independent. Hi, Marty.
Hey, Jennifer. How are you?
Good.
Good. So I wanted to weigh in. I've taken kind of a lot of heat for advocating four elements of the tax reform bill. I mean, I felt like I don't want to just say, no, there's nothing to like. I want to approach, okay, I like this element. I don't like that element. I feel like that divide in politics where we're just kind of, you know, tossing rocks over the wall at each other is what we don't want. So I've taken a fair bit of heat of that, but that's the approach that I tried to take. I don't know what your panel's opinion of that might be.
Well, Marty, do you don't at some point you need to step back and look what the whole net effect of it is?
I mean, I think that's fair, Greg. I mean, the idea is clearly we need some business tax reform that levels the playing field for small business. I don't see a better way for us to get that. I do agree there are elements of the package overall, elimination of the historic preservation tax credit, for example, that are really problematic. I was kind of looking for the best way to advocate. I don't know if it found it or not, but it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, the corporate tax rate cut, I mean, almost everyone agrees that that's too high and that should be cut down. And I think that's what Marty's talking about. And we talked about a bipartisan way forward. That could have been, the central part of kind of a bipartisan bill. But I think you might be right, Marty. This might be the only way you get it now.
Marty, thanks for calling into the program. Yeah, we're going to go to, I think it's Magali, who has posted on Facebook, I recently read an article that tried hard to return the focus of the Me Too movement and resulting accusations of misconduct back to support for survivors and away from the House of Cards media flurry of big names falling. Do you have any comments on this idea?
Well, I think the big names issue is different from the Me Too movement, if I'm understanding the both of them correctly. I think, you know, certainly celebrities in disgrace is a longstanding staple of you know, the news diet. But I think the Me Too movement, to me, was more organic and kind of spreading awareness that this is not just an isolated case by, you know, a handful of monsters, but something that regular people are dealing with every day.
Sure, and I've read there are concerns out there that the focus will be on these power industries, whether it's media or law or politics,
and journalism.
Ben, as you mentioned earlier, what about the person working at a restaurant or the maid at a hotel or somebody who's, you know, that industry is not in the spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, everyone has come very quickly to this point where it's, you don't want to have a famous person with these allegations standing over you. I mean, Matt Lauer, the biggest star at NBC, was gone, I think, within 48 hours. So that's starting to pick up, but you know, as you said, where does that leave everyone else? And that's going to, I mean, the, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, that's going to be the legacy of all of this, is where are we at with the everyday sexual harassment power dynamic problem.
We'll go to Beverly.
I think it's a really important point. The cases that are getting the most attention, you know, the folks that are coming forward have high-powered lawyers with them and, you know, are also in some senses powerful as well. And I think Ben raised a really important point. What about the average person that doesn't have a big name lawyer to advocate for her? Where do they go? And that's a conversation that we really need to keep having. And I think Me Too began that, but it's a good point that there's a lot of work that remains to make sure that this isn't just about powerful perpetrators, but also powerful victims.
Beverly in Belfast, go ahead.
Hi. One of your guests previously was talking about people voting for a candidate because that candidate seems more attractive in some way, gets that person's attention in some way. I have been active as an environmentalist for a long time, and Mr. Trump has been able to make the case that I'm a paid protester. We get no money or very little money whatsoever to lobby. I was lobbying in D.C., went down with two other people from Maine, just two others. And on the steps of the Capitol, we met about 50 or 60 people who were all dressed in red T-shirts. They were all there to lobby, somebody. And I'm assuming it was a Republican because they're the ones that were getting the money. So climate change is wonky. People don't want to hear about it. And the media is being taken over more and more by large corporations. So I don't know. I don't know what to do to get the message out.
Beverly, thank you for your call. I think we have a very similar call with Ben calling from Portland. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do have a similar point, which is that you just discounted, or your commentators just discounted the calls coming from organized groups because they're organized groups. But really, by organizing is the only way that we as people can actually have our voices heard, whereas the wealthy donors get big speeches down in Biddeford with Ivanka Trump and Susan Collins. They get heard all the time. They also control the media. So really, why would you discount the voices of those of us who do get organized and call?
Yeah, I think we recognize. I mean, we read letters to the editor, and sometimes we'll see like a company or an industry will send something that looks like a real letter to the editor, but it's not, and we discount that. And then we'll see a number of letters coming from citizens who actually wrote their own letter and really feel strongly about something. And the fact that they clearly, were informed and got together doesn't make those letters less valuable. So I think that the distinction, there is an organized effort to call Susan Collins, but it's not groups that call Susan Collins. It's people pick up the phone and do it.
Well, sure, Greg, and we've done a program on Maine Calling before about how to get your voice heard, and had people who've worked in congressional offices, and they'll say that if a form letter has been filled in, if they get 100 of something that's identical with different names, they won't take it as seriously as the sincerely written, handwritten, or even just sincerely written letter that does not appear to be part of a template. Mm-hmm. So
right from the Women's March, right? This has been a message telling people to call your congressman and that's a form of organization. I mean,
Ben, thanks for your call. And it's going to be our last call today. Thank you always, all three of you, for being on the program today. Susan Young, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Wonder what December will bring. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Hopefully some holidays. Additional help from Rich Tozier, Owen Manahan. Jonathan Smith took our calls today. Maine Calling's produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, answers to your questions about the new blood pressure guidelines. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.